So Wally, I look at this scenario based on a real world event, and I think to myself, man, did this pilot have any business going into this Class Bravo airport in the first place? And if they did, how in the world is someone supposed to know in the midst of all that when it's time to like call it quits?
Certainly, GA pilots using big Class Bravo airports should not have a problem if they're properly prepared. This pilot felt that he was because he had been to other GA airports. But as I pointed out, they're not all the same. Houston Hobby has multiple runways, waves of traffic coming through. Other Class Bravo airports may not have those unique circumstances. So certainly GA pilots using large airports are a normal thing as long as a pilot is prepared for what they're going to do.
Yeah, Jeff, I think absolutely this pilot should feel comfortable going in there. They've been in Class Bravo airspace four times before, 300 hours in a Cirrus. That's plenty of time to feel comfortable going into Class Bravo. And in fact, I think more GA pilots should feel less intimidated about going into these kind of airports.
You know, I have a chance to fly into Salt Lake's Bravo all the time. And one of the things that this scenario is so familiar, you know, the controllers are handling pilots and two-person pilot crews, fast equipment. They're managing spacing. They've got a lot of on their plate on the other side of the microphone. But they forget not every airplane has a two-person crew and a pilot who knows the airplane. As soon as they get it on the ground, knows exactly what's going to happen. So they do give you a short approach, you know, keep it fast, all kinds of instructions that I think your GA pilot isn't used to. You know, those sound like orders that you have to follow. And the words unable can roll from your lips, or again, you don't have to accept all those things. That's what they want. They need to keep spacing. They have a job to do, and you're part of the mix. But the pilot in command authority is one of those things that you have to own. And unfortunately, the reality is you are inconveniencing the big boys, the big iron. And so you slow things down just by being in the pattern with those aircraft. So you already are kind of an inconvenience, but that means you have to kind of own it. And when they ask for a short approach, unable, I'd like an extended downwind, or I'd like an extended final, you have to be the authority of pilot in command and assert that authority. And that's hard to do.
Yeah, I disagree with Wally at my peril, I know, but in this case I will, because the choice number two, unable, extend the downwind, land, seems perfectly reasonable here. The person's done this, has landed at these types of airports before. In truth, they're a lot easier because sure, there's lots of traffic around, and in this situation, the pilot's dealing with a crosswind. But you know, this is a gigantic wide runway that they have to land on. And also, it's like, how long should it take a pilot to calm down? We've had this traumatic experience of having a couple of go-arounds. But it's like your downwind's going to take a few minutes. This guy's a Silicon Valley engineer, programmer. He's used to high-stress situations, theoretically. It's like, if you can take a deep breath, calm down, reorient, land, I just think that's a totally reasonable thing to do.
I hate to agree with Dave, but I guess I will. But I agree. You know, you have to be prepared if you're going to go into a Class Bravo airspace. And for me, it's about preparation. I would have done some approaches at my local airport, coming down the final at 140 knots, having to slow down to flap speed, put it on the runway, and be ready for that, because they're going to ask you that. You have to know you're going to be sequenced in with a bunch of commercial traffic, which are going much faster on final than you are. But then also, again, you have to be the pilot in command. And when you're not comfortable, I think that's the thing, is to say, I'm unable. Hey, what's the last 737 in that line of traffic? Just vector me in behind that flight, and then I'll have a 20-mile final. I can relax, and it's all about a stabilized approach, and then my day might have ended better.
Yeah, building a little bit on what Michael said here, the planning is very important. A part of mastering an aircraft, no matter what type of aircraft, is learning the power settings and configurations and pitch attitudes that result in predictable performance. And in this case, there was a requirement for a high-speed approach. That is also a predictable configuration and performance. It's something that could be practiced ahead of time. But also with the scenario, part of the planning is that when you do go into an airport, like a large Class B airport, sometimes the rules are very different from what you're used to. In this particular case, for instance, we're using runway 4 and runway 35. That's probably because of interaction with other Houston area airports and Bush Intercontinental Airport, because runway 4 has an almost direct crosswind and runway 35 has a tailwind. And the pilot needs to be prepared for the fact that the turning radii are going to be different and landing distances and requirements are going to be different, because sometimes when you're playing in that environment, you have to work with the winds that they give you.
You know, I feel like I want to rally a little bit to Wally's defense here, because sure, all of this is true. The pilot should have had those power settings and those speeds, and the pilot has been into Class Bravo airports before, although maybe it wasn't with this kind of weather and maybe it wasn't with this kind of traffic. I think there is a point when all of us reach kind of saturation, right? And clarity of thought and the ability to operate at that high level is compromised, right? And so how do you know how much of a mental reset you really need here? And if you ask for a long downwind after the last jet, well, you know, maybe that downwind takes you into next week because it's a constant flow of traffic.
You know, Wally mentioned something about a two strikes rule and you want to, and I agree with that. And we use that in the Thunderbirds quite often. You know, if you go up and you make three mental errors, and they might be small errors that in the moment aren't that important, but collectively they indicate that your head's just not in the game, then we would just safe them up and go home or put it on the deck for the day and say, let's come back another time. But in this case, some of these issues aren't the pilot's error. Right? It's the controller telling the pilot to go around, and she's complying with that. Yes, she makes a couple errors, but I don't feel like this has crossed the threshold where it's exceeded that sort of three strikes rule in my mind yet. So that's why I would continue with it, and I'm with Dave and some of the others. I would go more towards option two.
And I think that's huge. Knowing the headspace of the person on the other side of the microphone in the cockpit, whether this is got them flustered, or whether they can, you know, contain that, the changes, mentally process the change in runway. I've had, while I'm on base turn, my runway assignment changed three times. 1-6 left. Go to 1-7. 1-6 right. No, actually, we're going to put you on 1-7. You're doing that hand flying an IFR approach, single pilot. It's tough. You know, you're having to just do all kinds of flipping, and if that does have you off your game, you know, the chance to just, nope, let me go take a breather. But one of the things I also think, and this is really important, my biggest concern about Bravo airspace isn't the airspace, it's the taxiing. Once you're on the ground, those taxiways can be complex, and the taxi instructions, chances are you are not used to, you know, taxi Victor, you know, Hotel 9 to Golf, then Victor, then Hotel, you know, you just get a string of instructions. And unless you have the airport diagram out, you know, you really need to pull off the runway, stop, get oriented. Otherwise, what Wally said, you've got a runway incursion just waiting to happen, or some kind of incursion.
You know, my struggle in this scenario is really just separating in my mind the actual NTSB report accident that's attached from the scenario itself. Because in the scenario itself, it seems pretty cut and dried. Take a deep breath, regroup, land. And then you watch the actual situation in which the scenario is built, and it's tragic, and it's just crushingly sad, and it seems so easily avoidable. You know, that's a dissonance that's just happening in my head. And when you watch the NTSB report, you know, you'll probably feel the same way. But when I look at this set of facts in this scenario, I just say land on runway 4.
Yeah, back to the scenario also. Part of the pressure perhaps that was on the pilot is the fact that they're planning a 5 p.m. arrival to try to get a passenger through that taxi over to the terminal through security and onto a 6:30 p.m. flight. So each time they went around, it would become much more stressful in the cockpit. There would probably be some pressure put on them by the passenger who's sitting there looking at a watch, and it just becomes cumulative. But I'm going to sort of dissent a little bit here. Just because we can do a thing doesn't necessarily mean we should do a thing. And in this particular case, we have every right and every opportunity to fly into the Class B airspace. But I've been in situations like this, and actually, when you're trying to meet a schedule, it might actually be quicker to land at a nearby airport and put the passenger in an Uber and get them across town to the airport. And that might have been an option here, too, when you're trying to push a schedule like this.
Well, it looks like I'm in the minority today. And that's fine, because certainly getting the extended final and landing would have been my second choice. I think all of you have made a good point that a pilot needs to be prepared to fly into this airport. And in my view, this pilot had demonstrated that they weren't up to that level at this point. And that influenced my decision. I think, Dave, you're right. Also, the fact that I knew the outcome influenced my decision. So I think you need to be prepared. And in my view, this pilot just had demonstrated they couldn't handle the task.
Yeah, I think one of the other things, sometimes, you know, coming back to just because you can doesn't mean you should. And one of the things, any decision in accepting a mission that you know is going to induce pressure, you know, that was too tight a schedule for a GA pilot to accept, because it makes hobby the airport you're going to land at. You were built in a mode of failure of get there-itis into your planning process. And that's one of the things, one of my pre-flight checklists is always to go through at the end of the pre-flight, say, what is it about this mission that is an NTSB report beginning sentence? Because in this one, the pilot had a schedule to make. Mm-hmm. That is the opening sentence of the NTSB report. And that's something you can mitigate before you even turn the propeller on.
And if your passenger thinks that she's in peril now, just wait till she gets to the bachelorette party in San Diego, because it's like, that's where the danger really starts.
Well, I'm hearing this, and it makes sense. And you bring up the NTSB report from the real event, and it is tragic. But at the same time, we are advocates for general aviation. We want pilots to do things. And, you know, getting across town in Houston versus landing at the airport, I mean, that could be a difference of like, you know, an hour and a half from the nearest physical other airport. So if we're promoting this kind of thing, what's the balance there of like, hey, I want to push my envelope a little bit and be prepared for that, but I also don't want to overextend myself for a 300-hour pilot who's clearly like, you know, excited about GA. Like, these are the people we want to go fly places, right?
Yeah, Jeff, I think there's a real distinction between confidence and arrogance. There's no place for arrogance in a cockpit in my mind, but there's every place for confidence. So you want pilots to go in being confident of their ability and confident of the situation. So in this case, you're in Class Bravo airspace. Yeah, there's 737s all around. You're at Houston Hobby. But you have the right to be there. And there are a couple things in here that bothered me. The pilot accepted vectors around a 3.5, which would put a pretty healthy tailwind on him coming in. Never should have accepted that in the first place. And kind of as Michael mentioned earlier, that ability to step forward and say, you know, think in your mind, I belong here. I'm confident in my abilities, and I'm going to do what's right for me and my airplane and fitting in the system.
I always try to think about really my own personal limitations and my currency versus my proficiency on any day. And if it were me and I was thinking, hey, and I was going to give advice to a 300-hour pilot that's going to go into Houston Hobby, my advice would have been to take a flight instructor with you. And clearly you're going to go to Hobby. It's going to be expensive to land there. The fuel is expensive there. So you're not worried about cost. And putting a flight instructor with you and use it as a learning event and increasing the safety of the whole thing, I think for me would have been the way that I would have approached it.
I think the one thing that I definitely, again, hindsight 2020, start way earlier. You know, all my flights, every single personal flight I take, I definitely approach it as a point to relax, take my time, enjoy it. You know, to me, anytime I'm pressuring myself to get somewhere, it's just a bad formula. And that to me, look, you have the right to be in Bravo. You've 300 hours, you've tried it, you've done it a couple times, go in, but don't add pressure. Go in with the ability to land, go have lunch, and then get the passenger to the terminal, and where you where the question of pressure is never even there because you already know you're going into a high pressure environment, going into a Class Bravo airport. So take pressure off yourself by not making it also a schedule issue.
I think that's exactly a great point. I mean, we talk about the PAVE model, the four major risk elements, and the external pressure that this pilot put on themselves for two reasons. One, they set that schedule very tight. Number two, they could have found out when the waves come and go at Houston and moved their schedule to a point that was a low period. That would have removed both external pressures to make this trip a lot safer.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, you're doing something that's at the edge of your comfort and maybe at the edge of your ability, but it's something you want to do, you have a right to do, and it's exciting to do. That's part of why you're flying in the first place. So how can you offload the extra stress that's on that? Maybe it's by moving things temporarily and giving yourself extra hours beforehand. Maybe it's bringing along an instructor or another qualified pilot, somebody who can split the workload with you with clear roles. And certainly it's preparation and knowing, you know, the airport, the layout, where you're going to go, having someone help you think through, okay, those are the winds. So, wow, that's a tailwind on runway 35. We can't even take that one to begin with. Way back out before you're in the fray with the other aircraft and ATC who has split priorities themselves about what's going on, that, I think, could have made this a scenario where we weren't even talking about it because someone took their friend to the airport, had lunch, went their separate ways, and everybody got to go home happy.